Penguin Random House Audio presents The Voyage Home by Pat Barker. Read for you by Kristen Atherton.
Chapter 1. She had yellow eyes. At times, particularly by candlelight, they scarcely looked like human eyes at all. Calchas, the priest, once said they reminded him of a goat's eyes, that she had the same numbed look of a sacrifice. I never saw her like that. She reminded me of a sea eagle, a common enough bird on the coast where I grew up. The sailors call it the eagle with the sunlit eyes. And its eyes are beautiful, but it doesn't do to forget the brutal beak, the talons sharp enough to tear living flesh from bone. No, I didn't see her as a victim. But then I knew her better than most. I was her body slave, or, to use the common vulgar term slaves themselves use, her catch fart. And I hated it. That day, the day we finally abandoned the Greek camp and set sail for home, I was feeling really fed up with her, because she'd kept me awake half the night praying. If you could call it praying. To me, it sounded more like a married couple having a row. Apollo didn't say much. In fact, nothing that I could hear. She was saying, "Home, home," over and over again, as if it were the worst swear word in her vocabulary. I knew what she meant, because whatever unimaginable place our Greek captors were taking us to, it certainly wouldn't be home. Home, for me, had been a little white house on the side of a hill, the back garden so steep I had to cut terraces into it to grow my herbs. I loved that garden. There were goats at the top of the hill, so my days were punctuated by the clanking of bells. For Cassandra, home had been first a palace, then a temple, both now in ruins, just like my house. A shared misfortune that should probably have brought us closer than it did. Leaving Cassandra with the cart and the baggage, I walked round the hut for the last time, checking to see we'd left nothing behind. Or that she'd left nothing behind. I didn't have anything to leave. The floorboards were gritty under my feet, the sand already starting to encroach. Normally, sweeping that out every morning was one of my jobs, but the last few days I hadn't bothered. What was the point? The sand would be everywhere soon, piling up in corners, wedging doors shut. And after that, the winter storms would begin, finding cracks in walls, blistering paint, warping wood until only a few spars would remain, scattered across a beach that had swallowed everything else. There was a bitter satisfaction in knowing that the ruined marble palaces and temples of Troy would endure for centuries to come, while in a few short years the Greek camp would vanish without trace. Being alone like this, even for a few moments, was a luxury. For the past 2 months, I'd shared the hut with Cassandra, who'd been in a state of divine frenzy when she arrived, clothes ripped, skirt bloodied and stained with semen. Nobody who saw Cassandra in those first days ever forgot it. Holding two blazing torches above her head, she whirled around the overcrowded hut, hair and skirt flying, shouting, "Come on, get up! What's wrong with you all? Dance!" Her mother and sisters cowered away from her. "Come on! What's the matter with you?" She was kicking her mother's shins at this point. "Get up! Dance! Dance!" And Hecuba, desperate to calm her demented daughter down, shuffled her scaly old feet from side to side. A further moment of horror in the old queen's life, seeing her daughter reduced to this, a pathetic creature with spittle on her chin and garlands of dead flowers drooping from her neck. "Come on, all of you, dance at my wedding." What wedding? Like every other woman in the camp, Cassandra was facing a lifetime of slavery. Royal birth, her status as a high priestess of Apollo, none of that would be enough to save her. Like everybody else there, like her own mother, She wasn't an important person anymore. In fact, she wasn't any kind of person. She was a thing, because that's what a slave is. And not just in other people's eyes, the people who own her and use or abuse her. No, it's worse than that. You become a thing even in your own estimation. It takes a strong spirit, a strong mind, to resist the stripping away of your old identity. Most of us can't do it. And yet here was Cassandra, who, if half the stories were true, was as mad as a box of snakes, prophesying that she was about to become the wife of a great king.
Rejoice!
They all had to rejoice with her, not because she was going to marry the richest, most powerful man in the Greek world, but because her marriage would lead directly to his death.
Look at him, she was saying, riding in triumph over dead children. King of kings, lord of lords, and yet this hero, this mortal god, will die the death of a stuck pig on a slaughterhouse floor.
Her own death was of no importance. She'd go down into the darkness crowned with laurels, having done what her brothers, for all their strength and courage, had failed to do: bring Agamemnon's head level with the dirt.
Deluded.
I don't remember anybody saying the word, but then it didn't need to be said. Her sisters exchanged pitying glances, though I noticed that not one of them tried to console her. Even surrounded by the women of her own family, she was completely alone. She wasn't despised exactly, but nobody believed her prophecies. In fact, nobody listened to a word she said. But then, and this was as unexpected as a flash of lightning in a clear blue sky, Agamemnon chose her as his prize. I was there. I felt the ripple of surprise, even consternation, that spread around the arena. Afterwards, as the crowd dispersed, I overheard a couple of Greek fighters talking.
Bloody hell, I wouldn't want that in my bed.
No, you'd never dare sleep.
Did you see her with them torches? Bloody near set the place alight.
Well, I suppose if all else fails, they'll just tie her to the bed.
As it turned out, he wasn't far wrong about that. For her own safety, she was kept locked up, and I was the lucky soul sent to take care of her. The ranting, the raving, the spitting and pissing went on as before, but behind closed doors. I followed her sister's example and ignored the rants. No easy matter when they're being shouted in your ear in the middle of the night. What I couldn't ignore was the obsession with fire. Every minute she was watching me, waiting for me to go to sleep so she could get out of the hut and grab torches from the sconces that lined the path outside. I'd wake and find the door wide open, cold night air streaming in, and Cassandra outside on the path, whirling torches in great arcs of flame above her head. No doubt in her poor, crazed mind, they were the torches of Hymen that light a virgin bride to her marriage bed. Hour after hour, I lay awake, staring at the rafters, afraid even to close my eyes in case I dropped off to sleep. Divine frenzy, people called it. But to me, supervising her every waking minute, combing her hair, washing her face, changing her bloody clouts, even that she couldn't do for herself, there was nothing divine about it. When finally she began to calm down, when she no longer paced the floor for hours on end, spit flying, fingers snatching empty air, when she sat up in bed and accepted a cup of cold water, having slept non-stop for 15 hours, I was broken. As close to physical and mental collapse as I've ever been. But curious, too. Despite the weeks of enforced intimacy, I felt I didn't know this woman at all. And I wanted to. Unfortunately, almost everything I'd learned about her since then repelled me. And, insofar as she bothered to notice me at all, she returned the dislike. I'd seen her at her worst, dribbling and drooling in urine-soaked sheets. You can dress it up whichever way you like, but the simple fact was, I'd seen too much. I knew too much. Sometimes I think she found it difficult to be in the same room as me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?